The Rhone Glacier in the Alps started to melt 2,400 years ago, in the middle of the first millennium. This calculation of de l'Apparent coincides with that at which we arrived by dating the last catastrophe in 687. In this catastrophe, many older glaciers melted, and the subsequent increased evaporation and precipitation built other glaciers that before long also started to melt, a process that has been going on ever since. Many glaciers of the Alps, it was recently learned with surprise, are less than 4,000 years old. Flint. Catastrophic changes in climate, found by Cernander and others in Scandinavia, correspond almost exactly with our dates. In the second millennium, about 1,500, and once more, 800 to 700 years before the present era, or 30, 4 and almost 27 centuries ago. The same dates are established through pollen analysis by Gams and Nordhagen for the catastrophic changes of climate in German fens and tectonic disturbances in Central Europe, and again the same dates, close to the middle of the second millennium before the present era and once more following the year 800, are fixed by Perrett and other authors for the climatic catastrophes that are reflected in the history of the lake dwellings in Germany, Switzerland, and northern Italy. Careful investigation by W. A. Johnston of the Niagara River bed disclosed that the present channel was cut by the falls less than 4,000 years ago. An equally careful investigation of the Bear River Delta by Hansen, who compared measurements repeated in periodic surveys, showed that the age of this delta is 3,600 years, its origin going back to the middle of the second millennium before the present era. Warren Upham's research on the Great Glacial Lake gases and the striations of the exposed rocks there indicates that the lake was formed but a few thousand years ago and existed for a short time only. The study by Claude Jones of the lakes of the Great Basin showed that these lakes, remnants of larger glacial lakes, have existed only about 3,500 years, and also that the Ice Age fauna survived to a date equally recent. Gale obtained the same results on Owens Lake in California and also Van Winkle on Abbott and Summer Lakes in Oregon. Radiocarbon analysis by Libby also indicates that plants associated with extinct animals, mastodons, in Mexico are probably only 3,500 years old. Similar conclusions concerning the late survival of the Pleistocene fauna were drawn by various field workers in many parts of the American continent. Suess and Rubin found with the help of radiocarbon analysis that in the mountains of the western United States ice advanced only 3,000 years ago. The study of the magnetic properties of the clay of Etruscan vases points to a reversal of the general magnetic field of the Earth, and also to a passage of the Earth through strong magnetic fields in historical times. The Florida fossil beds at Vero and Melbourne proved, by the artifacts found there together with human bones and the remains of animals, many of which are extinct, that these fossil beds were deposited between 2,000 and 4,000 years ago. As brought out by Godwin, the two eruptions of the sea on English shores also took place sometime in the second and first millennia before the present era. According to an earlier work, by Prestwich, the eruption of the sea was of a very violent nature. It spread to central France and the French Riviera, to Gibraltar, Corsica, and Sicily, and to the entire area that stretches to the lands of the ancient East. In all these places animal bones have been found broken but fresh. These bones of extant and extinct species have been found in fissures and caverns, sometimes on the tops of high hills, in great numbers. The bones found in English caves, covered with diluvium, were also described as fresh and unfossilized. From observations on beaches in numerous places all over the world, Daly concluded that there was a change in the ocean level, which dropped 16 to 20 feet 3,500 years ago. Clunin and others confirmed Daly's findings with evidence derived from Europe. To these closely dated geological, climatological, and archaeological evidences of catastrophes, we may add numerous others which also point to the recency of the great upheavals. Animals, torn and broken, many of which are of extinct forms, are found in enormous heaps in Alaska, their bones and skin still fresh, The mammoth meat discovered in Siberia is still edible. The bones of hippopotami and the rock fishes of England still retain their organic matter. The mountain chains of China and Tibet, of the Andes, the Alps, the Rockies, and the Caucasus rose to their present heights in the late Stone and even in the Bronze Age, and at those times, post-glacial, Africa was torn by the Great Rift. We have the same late dating from all parts of the world, and what is even more important, by all kinds of calendars, calculations, and approaches. And actually the figures brought together on these pages are from the fields of archaeology and climatology, and from fossil beds and waterfalls and deltas and fens, pollen analysis, from lake dwellings and glaciers and ocean evils and the magnetic polarity of the Earth, disclosing the same events and the same dates. Chapter 13, Collapsing Schemes. Geology and Archaeology. Measured by anthropological and archaeological evidence, the age of many finds is recent, measured by the prevailing geological and paleontological schemes. The dates of the same finds are many times more remote. This conflict was very sharp in the case of the Vrow and Melbourne, Florida, beds containing fossils and artifacts, and it repeated itself in a great many places. Rummer brought together a wealth of material to show the late survival of Pleistocene fauna and was widely quoted by archaeologists. A. Kroeber sees no easy way to avoid the conclusion that some of the associations of human artifacts with extinct animals may be no more than 3,000 years old and not 25,000 years old. Like Jones, he assumes that the Ice Age fauna survived until such a recent time by going through a process of slow extinction. But the idea of the slow and gradual extinction of Ice Age fauna is opposed by students of the problem, who feel that sudden and decisive geological or climatic changes occurred which simultaneously wiped out a considerable number of animal species. From the evidence turned up on the European continent, where documentation from early post-glacial sites is much more complete, we find a rather sudden disappearance of the fauna. When measured by archaeological standards, however, the artifacts and other remains of human origin found with the fossils point to a much closer date in Europe too. K. Sandford, writing of the conflict of views between geologists and archaeologists in England, says, "The difference of opinion in some instances is so complete that one or the other must assuredly be wrong. Those who measure the time in terms of cultural or physical anthropology and archaeology stand in very definite opposition to all estimates based on a geological or a paleontological time scale." As an additional argument, the archaeologist points to pictures of extinct animals in Babylonian and Egyptian bas-reliefs, the bones of which have actually been found. And the anthropologist believes that even oral traditions concerning extinct animals are grounds for far-reaching conclusions. Archaeology has proved that the American Indian hunted and killed elephants. It has also strongly indicated that these elephants have been extinct for several thousand years. This means that the traditions of the Indians recalling these animals have retained their historical validity for great stretches of time. Exactly how long? It is impossible to say. Probably the minimum is 3,000 years. If some Indian traditions have remained historical for so many years, undoubtedly traditions of other races and peoples have also. The animals of the La Brea asphalt pits in Los Angeles were first regarded as belonging to the opening of the Pleistocene or Ice Age, almost a million years ago. Then, the close relation between the Laontan fossils and those of La Brea compelled a change in this estimate and the assignment of the fauna of La Brea, as well as the similar fauna of other asphalt pits in California to the end of the Ice Age, presumably 20 or 30,000 years ago. Perhaps most striking is the conclusion that if these so-called early Pleistocene assemblages are actually late Pleistocene in age, early quaternary vertebrate faunas are as yet practically unknown in the western United States. This radically revised view was not limited to the western coast of North America. The fauna that, two or three decades ago, was thought to have perished at the advent of the glacial periods is now thought to have survived the entire Ice Age and to have perished at its very end. It seems odd that a fauna which had survived the great ice movement should die at its close. But diet did. Yet even the reduction of the time when the major part of the Pleistocene fauna succumbed on the western coast from 1 million years to only 30 or 20 or even 10,000 years is insufficient if Jones's estimate of the age of Lynotton deposits is correct. According to his analysis of the salt accumulation in the residual lakes of the larger Lake Lynotton, this glacial lake came into existence only 3,500 years ago, and the fauna found in its deposit could not be older. This compelled further vacillations. J. R. Schultz, writing on the fauna of the Dar Seeps in California, says that in view of the established correlation of the fauna of La Brea and the fauna of Lake Lynotton, it is now possible to reconcile the vertebrate evidence even with the opinion of Jones as to the relatively late age of the lake. Would this really signify that the extinct animals of the asphalt pits are only 3,000 or 4,000 years old? This would mean that these bones were deposited in the time of the recorded history of Egypt and Babylonia. Thus we witness a return to the view held by American geologists in the latter part of the 19th and the beginning of the present century: George Frederick Wright, Newton Horace Winchell, Warren Upham. Wright concluded that the Ice Age did not close until about the time that the civilization of Egypt, Babylonia and Western Turkestan had attained a high degree of development, and this in opposition to the greatly exaggerated ideas of the antiquity of the glacial epoch. Toward this view, with slow steps, scientific opinion is approaching, though it still maintains that there was a great gap between the Ice Age and the beginning of recorded history. The survival of many Ice Age animals until the second millennium before the present era notwithstanding. Collapsing schemes. In 1829, Gerard Deshayes published his studies on the fossiliferous strata in the Paris area, where marine animals alternate with land animals. These strata disclosed that in the upper marine bed were many kinds of shell-bearing mollusks that still inhabit the waters of the sea, and that the deeper the stratum, the fewer the living forms of mollusks. Following the publication of Deshayes's work, Lyell devised a timetable of geological ages. The fossilized remains of ancient animals indicate changes in fauna in the course of time. Lyell's measurement of geological periods is based on such changes in the animal kingdom, especially among the shell fauna. He found that there has been in the Quaternary, or the Age of Man, not more than 1/20th of the evolution that has occurred since the Lower Miocene, middle series of Tertiary, the Age of Mammals. From that point on, he traced one complete cycle of evolution, during which, at his estimate, practically all species that existed at the opening of the cycle were replaced by a new species. Thus, if our figure of 1 million years is accepted for the Age of Man, which started with the close of the Tertiary epoch, then 20 million years were needed to accomplish the changes observed since the Lower Miocene, and four such cycles of transformation of life forms must have passed since the end of the Mesozoic, or the Age of Reptiles. By this method, Lyell reckoned 12 cycles, or 240 million years, from the beginning of the Paleozoic, or the time of early life forms on the Earth. This figure is now considerably increased. The other figures are accepted at Lyell's valuation. Lyell's scheme, perfected by the introduction of new subdivisions of geological epochs, sets forth the following rule. If a stratum contains 90 to 100% modern species of shells, the stratum is Pleistocene, or of the Ice Age. If it contains 40 to 90% modern species of shells, the stratum belongs to the last subdivision of Tertiary, the Pliocene. If only 20 to 40% of the shells in a stratum are present day varieties, then the stratum is of Miocene time, an earlier subdivision of the Tertiary, and so on, down to the stratum where shells of extant species of mollusks find no direct ancestors. Lyell's time system is based on the assumption that no catastrophic events intervened and that the extirpation of species was the result of slow extinction, which Darwin's theory ascribes to the survival of the fittest in the struggle for the limited means of existence. But if great catastrophes occurred on the surface of the Earth and in the depths of the seas, of more than local character, and if in such upheavals some forms of life perished and others survived, and the progeny of still others underwent strong mutations, then the entire scheme of percentages and time allotment by the multiplication of changes observed in the last epoch, with its preconceived plan and rigidity, is no more valid than the pronouncements of some theologians, like Archbishop Usher of Ireland, who in 1654 declared that the creation took place at 9 o'clock in the morning on the 26th day of October in the year 4004 BC. The present work does not suggest either a lengthening or a shortening of the estimated age of the Earth or the universe, which during the few years when this book was being written rose from 2 to 6 billion years. I do not see why to a truly religious mind a small and short-lived universe is a better proof of its having been devised by an absolute intelligence. Neither do I see how by removing many unsolved problems in geology to very remote ages we contribute to their solution or elucidate their enigmatic nature. Whatever the age of the universe and the Earth, single geological epochs were of very different length than has been assumed on the ground of the theory of uniformity. The very concept of a 60-million-year-long tertiary when mountains were uplifted, followed by 1 million years of ice age, a time of great climatic changes, followed by 30,000 years of the tranquility of recent time, with quietude in mountain building and stability in climate, is basically wrong. The mountain building went on during the ice age, coinciding with climatic catastrophes, and both endured into recent time, only a few thousand years ago. In early ages, when the earlier rocks are investigated, they are found to be records of great upheavals in comparison with which the upheavals of later times appear only minor. Along the Canadian border west of Lake Superior in the Keewatin area, a complex of ancient lava flows and interbedded sedimentary rock reached, according to C.O. Dunbar of Yale, the impressive thickness of 20,000 feet. At Michipicoten Bay, the volcanic tuff is 11,000 feet thick. In the same area of Lake Superior, a later flow of lava, in Queenawan, still very early in the history of the world, has been estimated at 24,000 cubic miles, and in northern Michigan and Wisconsin, the Queenawan system may reach 50,000 feet, much more than half of which is made of lava flows. It stirs the imagination to contemplate the 2 million square miles of granite gneiss that floors the Canadian Shield, and to realize that it all came into place as fluid magma, which congealed beneath a cover of older rocks now long since removed by erosion. The impression is gained that during these primeval eras the crust of the Earth was repeatedly broken and largely engulfed in upwellings of molten material. In these pre-Cambrian lavas, glacial deposits were found in Canada as well as in Australia and South Africa, with boulders in part rounded and in part angular, and some of them faceted and striated. The detection of this evidence of early glaciation came at first as a shocking discovery, because it appeared a serious obstacle to the belief that the Earth was originally molten. Later, however, geologists, by placing some half a billion years between the origin of the Earth and the early ice phenomena, allowed the rocks to cool off first. Then in Cambrian time seas flooded the continents, and dolomite and metamorphose rocks 3,000 to 4,000 feet thick were formed. Only lower animal life was present in the world. Yet the simplest, unspecialized ancestors of modern animals, are most intensely modern themselves in the zoological sense and belong to the same order of nature as that which prevails at the present day. In Ordovician time the sea submerged fully half of the present American continent and reduced it to a group of great islands. In the beginning of that period, the marine waters also spilled over and at times spread widely across the central and eastern part of the United States. Later in that period a vast sea spread southward from the Arctic across central Canada to join the southern embayments that occupied much of the United States. Mountains were rising, folding, and overthrusting, in the so-called Taconian disturbance. This was accompanied by volcanic activity. Ash fell from Alabama to New York, and even as far west as Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa. The ash beds vary in thickness from a few inches up to more than 7 feet. The greatest display of volcanic activity, however, is found farther to the northeast, in Quebec and Newfoundland, where volcanic tuff of great thickness represents the epoch. At the same time, coral reefs were built in Arctic Canada, from Alaska to Manitoba, as well as in Newfoundland and northern Greenland. Indications of an ice age, Ptiliks, are found in northern Norway, and if they are of the same age, they certainly present a problem, because of the coral reefs that then grew in the north. Life was concentrated in water, the sea was inhabited by thousands of species. In the following Silurian period, volcanic activity broke out with new vigor. In New Brunswick and especially in southeastern Maine, ash beds and lava flows attain the impressive thickness of 10,000 feet and more. Also in southern Alaska and northern California there are imposing lava flows, volcanic breccia, and tuff dating from this time. The close of this period was marked by the so-called Caledonian disturbance in Europe, with a mountain crest rising across the British Isles and Scandinavia. Throughout the length of Norway and Sweden, a distance exceeding 1,100 miles, the pre-Devonian formations were folded, overturned, and overthrust with eastward movement on individual fault planes as great as 20 to 40 miles. Again, coral grew in Arctic regions. The next Devonian period was marked by a so-called Acadian disturbance, with uplifts and depressions. Much igneous activity accompanied the Acadian disturbance. Great thickness of bedded lavas and turfs in southern Quebec, Gaspé, New Brunswick, and Maine record volcanoes that were active during Devonian time. Magma intruded and lifted the White Mountains and built their granite core. Similar processes went on in other parts of the world. The Old Red Sandstone of Europe is a Devonian formation. In eastern Australia, mountains were formed that stretched the full length of the eastern border of the continent. Much igneous activity had occurred during the period in this region, and the Devonian strata and associated volcanics are said to be over 30,000 feet thick. Throughout Devonian time, North America must have been connected with Europe by a land bridge, which later subsided beneath the North Atlantic. Evidence that these two lands met is found in the land plants and freshwater animals preserved in the Devonian rocks of the two regions, which are so much alike on both sides of the Atlantic that it seems clear they were free to migrate across an easy land bridge. In the Carboniferous period, mountains were made, seas invaded land, corals built reefs on the Arctic coast of Alaska and on the polar islands of Spitsbergen, volcanoes erupted, and glaciation took place, especially in Australia. Land animals left their records beside those of rich marine life. Coal beds were formed. In the coal basins of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, the coal measures reach a thickness of a few thousand to 13,000 feet. Extensive continental glaciation of India, South Africa, South America, and Australia took place. Here I stop quoting from historical geology. Again and again, the world was a playground for Vulcan and Poseidon, the elementary forces of melting rock and trespassing sea. But when all is told, we are nevertheless assured that the geological record is one of calm and uniformity, and what appears as revolution is a telescoped view of slow and ordinary processes. Even the seas of lava, though obviously formed in single paroxysms, are, in the overall picture, denied a catastrophic origin. One reads, "It is not obvious that the city of Boston rests on the surface of one of the world's greatest mountain chains, yet it does. It had been depressed and also eroded." One reads also that Boston lay in the equatorial rain zone during the Carboniferous and in the region of hot deserts during the Permian. One is, furthermore, told that the site of Boston was once under the sea, and that it was once also under a mile-thick cap of ice. It is insisted that all these changes took place without any upheavals in nature, merely as effects of processes and agents active also in our own time, the highest mountains becoming flat, equatorial jungles giving place to hot sand deserts and hot deserts to a polar cover of ice, and the polar cover of ice to the bottom of the sea and the bottom of the sea to the site of Harvard University. It all happened so slowly that no living creature ever perceived the change. Coal is found in layers that are ascribed to various ages mainly on the basis of fossils found in them. Brown coal is a compacted mass of plant remains. Lignite brown coal is made chiefly out of trees only partially converted into coal. Soft or bituminous coal is brittle and of bright luster and contains sulfur. Its organic nature can sometimes be seen under a lens, and the plants that participated in its formation can be recognized by leaves in the shales on top of the coal bed. Anthracite or hard coal is metamorphosed bituminous coal. The plants that went into the formation of ancient beds include chiefly ferns and cycads. Layers of later ages are composed of sassafras, laurel, tulip tree, magnolia, cinnamon, sequoia, poplar, willow, maple, birch, chestnut, alder, beech, elm, palm, fig tree, cypress, oak, rose, plum, almond, myrtle, acacia, and many other species. The origin of the coal beds is still far from being satisfactorily explained. One theory would make peat bogs the place where, in a slow process measured by tens and hundreds of thousands of years, coal was born. It is said that the plants fall, but before they decompose in the air they are covered by the water of the swamps. A layer of sand is deposited over them, forming the soil for new plants, and thus the process repeats itself. In order that the layer of sand may be deposited, it is necessary that these marshy regions be covered by water in motion. Since almost regularly marine shells and fossils are found on top of coal beds, the sea must have covered the swamps at one time. Then, for new land plants to grow there, the sea must have retreated. There are places where 60, 80, and 100 and more successive beds of coal have formed. This theory would then require that as many times the sea trespassed, when the land slowly subsided, and as many times retreated. In other words, this theory assumes that the ground is pulsating and that the sea will return again sometime and cover the coal beds as it did 100 times in the past. Fossils of marine clams, snails are abundant in the shales just above each seam of coal. Later, with fluctuating sea level, the salt waters withdrew and another freshwater marsh came into being, giving rise to another bed of coal above the earlier one. Again we are surprised, this time by the large number of such alternations of coal with marine sediments. These are now recognized as distinct cycles, each cycle representing a common sequence of events. Ohio displays more than 40 such cycles, and in Wales more than 100 separate seams of coal have been discovered. Marvin Miller has given 400,000 years as the probable time represented by the average Ohio cycle. This scheme demands not only that the sea should have covered the land 100 times but also that after each retreat of the sea a fresh, water marsh should have appeared on the vacant ground in order to give the trees a place to grow and fall down and decay, and that the process of decay should have been checked before going too far. For otherwise the vegetable matter would have disappeared completely and none would have been left in the form of coal. And then each time not only was the real extent of the marshes remarkable but the thickness of the coal required a surprising accumulation of vegetable matter. Many kinds of plants and trees that went into the formation of coal do not grow in swamps, and when they die they remain on dry ground and decompose. This fact suffices to render the peat bog theory untenable. Seams of coal are sometimes 50 or more feet thick. No forest could make such a layer of coal. It is estimated that it would take a 12-foot layer of peat deposit to make a layer of coal 1 foot thick, and 12 feet of peat deposit would require plant remains 120 feet high. How tall and thick must a forest be, then, in order to create a seam of coal not 1 foot thick but 50? The plant remains must be 6,000 feet thick. In some places there must have been 50 to 100 successive huge forests, one replacing the other, since so many seams of coal are formed. But it is further questionable whether the forests grew one on top of the other, because a coal bed, undivided on one side, sometimes splits on the other side into numerous beds, with layers of limestone or other formations between. The consideration of the enormous mass of organic matter needed to form a coal seam brought about the birth of another theory of the origin of coal. Fallen trees were carried along by overflowing rivers, and coal was formed from them, not from the plants in situ. This theory explains the enormous accumulation of dying plants in some localities. It may be able to show why, in many cases, a fossilized tree trunk is embedded in coal with its lower part uppermost, or standing on its head, which the peat bog theory does not explain. But the drift theory cannot account for the fact that various kinds of marine life are mixed with the coal. Carbonaceous and bituminous shales are frequently packed with fossilized marine fish, deep sea crinoids and clear water ocean corals often alternate with the coal beds. Erratic boulders, too, are often encased in coal.